today. Did the decision to allow major sporting events to go ahead in March cost lives?
Well, obviously, You Never Walk Alone is my favourite song. You know, the new one that come along, We Conquered All Europe, I love. You know, it's a great song. I mean, all of them, you know, there's not a lot that I don't like. I love all the atmosphere. That's all part of going to watch Liverpool. It's like a family. The atmosphere's great, you know. Like, my boy now knows every single song. He even tries to start them off at away games. So, yeah, I mean, it was a great atmosphere on the night.
Anfield was buzzing on March the 11th as Liverpool took on Atletico Madrid in the Champions League.
Anfield, it's a big night. It's Steve McManaman and Darren Fletcher.
Anfield is a red raw coliseum. The players emerge with rain sweeping across the stadium. Liverpool have proved time and again that special things happen on special nights like this. The European champions have the artillery, but Simeone's soldiers are primed and ready for battle.
Lifelong supporter Simon Rinaldi remembers it vividly.
Yeah, it was a full house. It was a typical Liverpool European night. I mean, everyone was there, everyone was eager, everyone was like anticipating a great night. And, you know, to be honest with you, it was a great night in terms of the 90 minutes I thought was the best Liverpool had played. But, yeah, the atmosphere was rocking in there. It was amazing as normal, you know.
The coronavirus had found its way into Europe by then and was starting to dominate the news. The very day of the match, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic. But here in England, mass gatherings like sporting events went on as usual.
Obviously, I knew the situation with COVID, but the match was on. So in my head, it was safe enough to go. If I'm honest, I read an article in the paper the day before saying that the Spanish had called off their matches in Spain. You know, but just like any other football fan, and my boy was excited, we thought, well, it hasn't been called off, it must be safe enough to go.
In the weeks after that match, as the UK's COVID death toll began to climb faster than any other European country, Simon would come to question the judgment of ministers in letting the game go ahead. Others are now demanding an inquiry into the decision. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, did people die because the government waited too long to ban large events like racing festivals, concerts, and football matches?
I was always going to the match because I haven't missed a match all season.
On the afternoon of March the 11th, Simon and his 9-year-old son headed off from their home in Essex, excited about Liverpool's biggest game of the season so far, a knockout Champions League match against Atletico Madrid.
I mean, so I was always planning to go. But this one in particular, we got the later train because he had school. We rushed to Euston because we live in Essex. And we got the train together about 5 o'clock, which was the one that got in at 7-ish.
Was that train busy?
Yeah, it was very busy, yeah. I was surprised how busy it was for that late. And it was probably a good few hundred Atletico Madrid fans on that train that we passed on the way through. You know, I said hello to and just walked straight past them on the train. You know, they was having their beers like they normally do. And then when we got off the train, we walked to where the taxi was and we saw there was a big march of Atletico where they must have left the city centre, you know, to head up to the stadium. And then my friend turned up in a taxi and off we went to Anfield.
Once you got to the other end of the taxi, what was it like? What was the atmosphere like?
Oh, it was a great atmosphere, yeah. It was as normal. It was a European night. I mean, that's one thing you get with Liverpool. You have these great nights and, you know, they come around, you know, once or twice a year. And I thought, you know, it was all planned to be one of them. The atmosphere was great. We got in the stadium, met a few people who we normally sit next to.
There was a lot on the line. It was a big match.
Yeah, it was a big match, yeah. Liverpool needed to win.
Here, Liverpool, Salah on the left foot with a curler. And it didn't come down.
Yeah, needed to win by 2 goals. I thought they'd done enough to probably do that, but it wasn't to be on the night. But yeah, it was. I think it was the best they played all season. It was one of the things, once you're there, you forgot all about, you know, what was going on with the COVID. I mean, the atmosphere was there. I mean, you was back in Anfield. It's like a special place to me. So when you're in there, nothing else matters.
David Conn, you've just completed a Guardian investigation into whether mass gatherings, including this football match, should have gone ahead. This game was on March the 11th, the day COVID-19 was declared a pandemic. In Spain, they had just decided that football matches would be played in empty stadiums. Why did this go ahead?
Well, it wasn't just this match.
I want to stress that for the vast majority of the people of this country, we should be going about our business as usual.
And it was all major events. And on the 9th of March, the government, through the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, made a statement saying there is no rationale for stopping major events. And the basis was that even if you stopped them, they don't have a major impact on stopping the pandemic. But the overall context was nothing was being stopped in this country and the virus was being allowed to spread.
Why? What was the policy?
The argument for allowing major events that comes from some of the scientists is that they're low risk because somehow people are only gathering outdoors or mainly gathering outdoors, and actually it's not that many people in terms of a population.
If you look at what other countries have done, some of them have jumped very quick onto measures which actually may be slightly less effective and aren't concentrating on the ones that really are the most impactful.
But the reality was, even activities that are considered high risk, so all the pubs being open, all the schools being open, workplaces, travel, the tube, all flights coming in, well, nothing was being stopped. And so clearly from the statements that Sir Patrick Vallance, in particular, the chief scientific advisor, made, the policy was that the virus was being allowed to spread at that point.
Because it sort of sounds logical that stopping a mass event is going to be a big way to stop this. In fact, it's a small way to stop it. It doesn't mean we won't do it at some point, and there may well be a time when you need to do it anyway.
And eventually they would bring some measures in to flatten the peak, and they were looking to attain herd immunity from 60% of the population being infected and recovering.
That reasoning was why big events continued. It was business as usual, as the Prime Minister put it, with people travelling to and from the Cheltenham Festival.
And they're off. Away for the 2020 Magnus Cheltenham Gold Cup.
A Stereophonics concert in Manchester. A half marathon in Bath. And of course that exciting Champions League match in Liverpool, which Simon attended with his son.
There are cheers from the Atletico Madrid supporters here at Anfield tonight. The title will arrive in the coming days, there's no doubt, but Liverpool's reign as European champions comes to an end.
Straight after the match, obviously we lost and was a bit disappointed. My boy's obviously tired by now because extra time come along. The game started at 8, so it's probably getting to nearly 11 o'clock. The streets are packed with Liverpool fans all making their way home. And I always walk past the pub anyway, going back to the taxi, and that pub was packed solid, yeah. You know, fans just pour into pubs after games, you know, have their drinks and chat about the football and about the, you know, the match. So, yeah, I mean, it was a very busy place and still an atmosphere out there. But, I mean, we were straight home. The next day, I dropped my son off at school and I got a pub restaurant. You know, I got recruitment business at a pub restaurant, so I went in to visit all, sort of both of them and do a little bit of work that day, you know.
When did you start having symptoms?
On the Sunday, we had a roast dinner. Me and my wife and my son went in and had a roast dinner, sat with my dad who was working. I wasn't working that day. And I felt fine. You know, I didn't feel too bad. I was obviously following the COVID stories on the news and stuff like that at home, like you do. And then there was a party of about 25 people. One of them was my friend. It was his birthday. So we went and joined them maybe later on in their meal and we'd eaten, had a couple of wines. As I said, I don't really drink a lot, but on a Sunday I'll have a bottle of wine with the wife. And this particular Sunday I probably had two bottles of wine with her because, you know, there was people in the restaurant. And it all seemed to go well. They was all drunk, you know. I think it was a 40th birthday party, that, you know what I mean? And they was having a great time. Said our ways, sort of went home. And when I woke up on the Monday, I thought I had a bad hangover. And I thought, that's a bit unusual for me. I mean, I know I don't drink a lot, but... So I put it down as a hangover. And I think I pretty much stayed in Monday. Tuesday, I couldn't get out of bed. I felt really ill. And that's probably when I knew I was sick, you know. I thought, this is not me. And I was ill for at least 10 days. And I never left the house at all.
How did you feel?
I could not do anything. I couldn't get out of bed. I went downstairs to get a coffee and I had to go back and lay down. It, you know, a few nights it was hot sweats. And probably nearer the end of the week is when I could only take short breaths. I was like, and I felt like I had sort of grit in my lungs, you know.
Were you convinced it was COVID?
Yeah, I'm pretty convinced it was COVID. I mean, I've never had a test. I've never had anyone come and see me about it. But yeah, I'm pretty convinced because yeah, I've never felt that bad.
Did you start to think then where you might have caught it from?
Yeah, I mean, I had loads of thoughts about, I mean, I've got COVID here. I've got COVID. Where's it come from? So obviously my first thought was I've been to the football match. Obviously I've got a pub, so it could be in the pub. I've been around people in the pub. I also, I've mentioned, I've got a colleague who works for me and he went to Cheltenham with a lads one. And so in my head, like during the time of being ill, I'm thinking, like, has he called it at Cheltenham? Have I called it at Liverpool? Have I got it in the pub? So all that was going through my mind.
And the timing works for the football match, doesn't it?
It seems to work for the football match, yeah, because that was like almost probably 6 days before.
David, it seems totally mad now that these events went ahead. Not just in early March, but all the way up to the middle of the month. But even when they were considering banning them, Boris Johnson still suggested that he thought they were low risk.
We are considering the question of banning major public events such as sporting fixtures. And the scientific advice, as we've said over the last couple of weeks, is that this banning such events will have little effect on the spread.
What were the scientific papers they were looking at?
Honestly, we don't know if they were even looking at scientific papers. I've asked some of the scientists on SAGE and other experts, what is the actual science? So we know the advice from the scientists was these are low risk because people are spectating outdoors and they mainly just stay with the people that they came to the event with. And in a population-wide scale, it's not that many people. But I've used the phrase, it just looks alarmingly superficial for anyone who knows what these events are like. They're mega events now, and they don't just involve spectating outside. There's an enormous amount of eating and drinking and cramming together. But there just do not seem to be scientific papers that have really rigorously examined how do people interact at these events. It seems to be based on assumptions, and I mean at the SAGE level, it seems to be that superficial.
Have you seen documents that showed any broader thinking than that, that looked at the reality, like you say, of an event like the Liverpool match or of an event like Cheltenham where people are also packing into pubs or packing into restaurants?
I asked John Edmonds, Professor John Edmonds of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who's a very prominent member of SAGE, that exact question. And he sent me a recent paper that they've published and said, we'll have a look at this. And in that paper, all it says about the events is if we assume that people have the same average number of contacts at an event as they do in their normal daily life. That's all it said. And I'd asked, have you got modelling for all the travelling, all the cramming together, all the drinking in pubs before and after, all the shopping, all the confined spaces, all the indoor activities that go on? And that's what he sent me in response. And another expert sent me, there's been a summary of all the different surveys, modelling of the human contact that people have in various places like schools and workplaces, a huge sort of, you know, literature review. And not one of them was at a sporting event or any a concert or a major event. And so at the moment, I have not seen anything that shows this was based on rigorous research.
And as you've said, it wasn't just public gatherings that were going ahead. Everything was going ahead, including high-risk things. So have you seen the science behind the wider policy?
Well, you know, what we're left with is the government now saying and insisting they were not allowing the virus to spread through the population and that herd immunity, attaining herd immunity from basically mass infection of people, was never part of the plan. But like literally we all lived through the same government ministers and scientists literally being on the media advising us that that's exactly what they were doing.
So we want to suppress it, not get rid of it completely, which you can't do anyway, not suppress it so we get the second peak, and also allow enough of us who are going to get mild illness to become immune to this to help with the sort of whole population response, which would protect everybody.
Yeah, I mean, that herd immunity, I know you talked about yesterday when you were appearing with the Prime Minister.
That you had to allow it to spread, that you couldn't bring in measures too early to slow it, because then you would get a big second peak later on. That was the thinking.
OK, so the specific question you've been investigating is whether the decision to let major events go ahead caused more people to fall ill. And that's really difficult to find out, because who knows where any individual person is infected. But you have been able to highlight a spike of cases and deaths in Liverpool and Cheltenham. And I know that with our communities editor, Caroline Bannock, you've done a call out for individual stories. What did you find?
I've just found it horrendous. I just think it's so many people. So it's more than 200 people. Okay, there were hundreds of thousands of people at those events, but for 200 people to get in touch and say, yes, I think that I was infected at those events. I think I then went home and infected other people in my family and friends. I think I infected people who were vulnerable and people who've then become critically ill and some people who've died. You know, I just find it a part of the scandal, which is the way that virus was allowed to spread when all the warnings were there and people were put in harm's way.
Coming up, Simon fears that he passed COVID-19 on. When Simon fell sick, he feared for his life. He told us that there were at least three nights when he was so panicked he called 111. But he wasn't the only one in his family to fall ill.
Well, obviously, I was locked up for 2 weeks in my house. And in the meantime, my dad, he'd fallen ill. He'd fallen weak, yeah. He kept saying he didn't have temperature. He kept saying, just let me rest. But he was very stubborn. Yeah, my dad's a sort of a character. I mean, he come from Italy in the 60s. He met me mum, who was from Liverpool. And he's always been the sort of person, I remember as a child, he was always doing two jobs. He's a complete workaholic. He's always been like that. Sort of later in life, we got a pub together because he'd finished his work, but he wasn't ready to retire. He said, I'm never going to retire, so I need to carry on working. So we got a pub. And then we eventually opened a restaurant about 18 months ago on the side of the pub. We called it Gino's, named it after him. So I probably spent the last year and a half working with him every day, which was great for me. I mean, and people all knew him in the town through the pub, through the restaurant, and he was really sort of well-respected. So before the Atletico Madrid match, I used to say to him, Dad, look, this COVID's quite serious. You should not be behind this bar, right? Honestly, I said, you're at risk. I said, you're older. I said, you've got high blood pressure. You got type 2 diabetes, you know, the old age stuff you get. But he would never listen. No, I'm not going anywhere. What am I going to do? Sit at home, that's what he used to say. On the Friday when Boris Johnson announced the pubs are shut, he was still there till they shut it at 8 o'clock that night. So I could not go and see him at that period because I was ill in bed. So when I went eventually see him, it was like he'd lost a stone and a half in weight, but he'd always play it down. No, I'm fine, leave me alone. That's what he was like. And all he wanted was the light off, the curtain shut. He didn't want to come out. You know, obviously me and my sister live with a bit of guilt here because we should have done more. But as I said, there was one conversation. I was there and she said, look, Dad, I'm ringing an ambulance. You don't look right. If you ring an ambulance, I'm jumping out that window. Leave me alone. I've watched these programmes. I'm not going to sit in a hospital on my own. I'm fine. Leave me here. I said, Dad, please, can we go to the hospital? And then by now he'd calmed down a bit. No, just to the doctors, just to the doctors. And I took him to the doctors. And, you know, I'm in a panic here because I've never dealt with anything like this. I mean, And I got him to the doctor's. By the time he walked in straight to the chair to have his blood test, he was breathing so heavy. He was like, he had a mask in him, I'd put on him and some gloves. I ripped the mask off him and said, Dad, you okay? You okay? And he didn't really communicate with me. He was just looking at me. And it was at this point that the nurse shouted out, can we have a doctor, please? Can we have a doctor? We've got a man here who's struggling to breathe. And you know what? Sorry, I'll take a breath here. This is the bit that I'm really angry with, which I try to hide, you know, sort of I have nightmares about this, like this moment. I try to get it out of my head, but there was a voice come from down the corridor. Is he one of our patients? And the nurse went, no, 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 he's come for a blood test. You have to take him to hospital then. So they didn't even want to come and help. I tried to walk my dad two steps and he fell in my arms. He went on the floor. He was obviously having a heart attack. And then eventually somebody come out and helped. But it was too late, you know. I was holding his head. They were giving him CPR.
Why weren't they helping? Because they thought he might have COVID.
I think they thought he had COVID and they were too scared to help. Eventually someone come out. They took over the CPR. I was holding my dad's head. Someone rang 999 by then. They come and they made me leave the room. And then he was there for 40 minutes. And by then I'd called both my sisters. They turned up. We was outside the surgery. And then obviously they come out there and said, listen, we've managed to get his heart going only on the monitor. We've managed to get him breathing on the monitor, you know, sort of like on a machine. But anyway, they took him to hospital. We followed. We stayed there 2 or 3 hours. Eventually a surgeon came out. He said, he's on the respiratory ward. I need to talk to you about him. I've had the description that your dad was working every day, quite fit, quite healthy. He looks quite fit, quite healthy. But his lungs are very clouded. He said, well, it looks like COVID to me. On top of the heart attack, you know, we're not going to be able to save him. You know, he's on a machine now. There's no way, that I can save this man. I'm being honest with you. And it was that, you know, there was 3 of us in the room. It was a horrible time. It was a tough time.
How did you feel?
Well, I just felt like my life had shattered, didn't it, in front of me. You know, my dad was everything to me, you know. Well, we all went in the room together. I mean, my dad was lying there. He was motionless. He's, you know, you could see he was probably brain dead, you know. He was gone. And we was all in pieces. And that's the way it panned out, you know. I mean, we had to do that. We had to leave him. We said our goodbyes, you know, because he said there was no way he could save him. I mean, there's all these things that go through my head, but I've got no doubt that he was a victim of COVID. As I said, that doctor told us, yes, here's another bit. But they take a swab when you go in the hospital, don't they? And then they come back and said the swab was negative, so he didn't have COVID. So that's even more confusing for us. And I've researched this, and they say that the swabs are only 68% successful. They can't rely on them all the time, so we don't know. So they've only put on his death certificate now as a heart attack.
Do you think that you can return to Anfield?
I don't think I find it hard to go back. No, I can't wait to go back. I mean, I love football. I mean, you know. I mean, I haven't mentioned this. I mean, I was at Hillsborough them years ago and I found it quite hard to go back to a football match for a few months after that. But then, what you know, once you do go back, it's fine. So I don't feel... I mean, I blame sort of what happened with the football, you know, on this COVID, on the situation going ahead, but I don't have direct blame. Like, I mean, Hillsborough's a completely different thing, which, you know, I mean, messed your head up even more, you know.
You were there.
Yeah, I was in the Leppins Lane that day. Yeah, I was only 18, yeah. So I have a lot of like, memories and bad memories of that. But that was harder to go back to a football match after that, yeah. You know? But I did eventually. So I will definitely go back to a football match after this.
It's pretty amazing to hear that Simon had not only been at this match, but had in fact been at Hillsborough when he was 18 years old. And you, of course, have been leading the reporting on Hillsborough for many years. And a response to that was to totally change the way we thought about safety in stadiums, wasn't it?
Well, apart from the justice campaign by the families, the bereaved families after the Hillsborough disaster for accountability, there was immediately an absolute overhaul of stadium safety. And it's all done by law. There was a whole body of legislation. There's a whole architecture of safety that has been designed that as English football rose again, nobody would die at a football stadium again, they would be safe. So to see the contrast between what happens in normal times when every effort is made to protect a single life, to think oh, well, we can let thousands of people turn up for these events, knowing that some will become infected, which is the advice. But on a population-wide level, it's not a big enough scale to stop them. And therefore, in effect, people will become sick and some people will die. It seems to be an inversion of the normal concern for public health.
That was back in March when many people feel they acted too late in banning matches. As we know, they did then shut down football and all other sporting events. Now they're going to restart the Premier League and they're going to do that really cautiously. Football is going to be played behind closed doors, so to empty stadiums. And that's even though COVID is spreading more slowly now than back then. So they must think it's high risk.
Well, here's just such a blatant contradiction. The government is still sending, in its response to this work that we're doing now, they're still saying they were low-risk events. There was a low risk of transmission. But when football restarts, which it's now due to do on the 17th of June, there will be no crowds. And they're even worried about a relatively few people gathering outside a stadium. So how can it be low risk? Why don't they let 54,000 people go into Anfield again if it was low risk?
Simon, can you tell me about your dad's funeral?
My dad's funeral, it was tough because I believe there would have been well over 1,000 people at his funeral. He was very popular. The messages for him, to me personally, both my sisters, was amazing. My dad wasn't even on social media. And the amount of tributes, the amount of messages, was amazing. So his funeral was really tough. I mean, we got him a horse and cart. We went from my mum's house, which is probably 4 miles from our restaurant, and passed it. And then we buried him, just only 10 of us was allowed. But on the route to the funeral, which made me cry with joy, and people did line the streets, they stood at a distance, they looked really behaved, and they clapped him as he went past. So it was probably a good few hundred people stood out for him, which was, you know, amazing to see. And it made me feel proud as I went past, you know. And nobody walked and followed it to the graveyard. We had a private burial, which, you know, I mean, first time, by the way, I'd seen my mum that day. Because the hospital had let the three of us around my dad. Now, me thinking I've had COVID, I'm all right, but then you don't know if it comes back. My two sisters hadn't, but we couldn't even go and hold my mum or hug my mum during this period. You know, she had people dropping food round at the door, and we spoke to her on the phone every day. But yeah, I mean, she spent the 2 weeks mourning on her own. You know, she couldn't have known it, and she didn't want to risk it either in case she caught it. You know, so I mean, just to think it out, I mean, it was terrible. You know, I couldn't even go around and hold my own mum. Even at the funeral, I couldn't hold my own mum. We just had to be at a distance.
She had her own. She couldn't. No one went within 2 metres.
Yeah. I know, it's crazy, isn't it? So it has been a tough time.
What sort of emotions have you felt in the weeks since then?
Well, I've got emotions of guilt. I've got emotions of sadness. You know, I miss my dad. I've got great joy that we spent that last time together, you know what I mean?
Are you angry?
I'm angry as well. I'm very angry. So, yeah, I feel guilt. I feel sorrow and some joy. And I'm angry. I'm angry that if the pubs would have shut 2 weeks earlier, if the matches wouldn't have went ahead, then maybe I wouldn't have gone. He wouldn't have still been working, yeah. So I'm definitely angry, you know. And maybe my dad would still be here, definitely. Maybe I wouldn't have got ill. I'm not so bothered about me getting ill, but if I did give it to him, yeah, of course I'm angry. I'm very angry, yeah. And I'm still angry when I watch what's going on today. And I mean, what are we learning from this? What are we doing? How many mistakes is this government going to make? I don't know. But I try to balance that anger out by thinking he was 75, he had a great life, he was much loved. He was struggling a little bit getting around the restaurant with his pains and his age, but, you know, nothing major. Maybe he's better off at peace, I don't know. So I have a lot going through my head.
75 feels quite young, though.
It does, yeah, it does. I mean, maybe, I think he was probably robbed of 10 years, yeah. You know, maybe.
That was Simon Rinaldi and David Conn. Do read his investigation, including some of the voices of more than 200 people who got in touch with The Guardian at theguardian.com. That's it for today.
Sending this out special to Simon Rinaldi and his family. This is for Gina. when you walk.
This episode is definitely dedicated to Gino and his family. Many thanks to Simon Rinaldi and to David Conn. This programme was produced by Mithili Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.
At the end of the storm, there's a golden sky and the sweet sea.